Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Ukraine's prime minister says Russia's motives in his country are clear. And Secretary of State John Kerry in the DRC offering aid conditionally. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk says Russia is seeking to destroy Ukraine by engineering clashes, including the fire that killed 42 mostly Russian activists in Odessa. Mr. Yatsenyuk visited the city today, 2 days after the deadly fire in the southern port city of 1 million people. Speaking to reporters, he accused Moscow of engaging in well-planned provocation against the interim Kiev government, saying destruction of the country and splitting the country. This is the Russian plan. He said Odessa was holding on for 2 months until Moscow sent more people to heat up the situation. He also noted that while Odessa is valuable for Russia, it is even more valuable for Ukrainians because it is Ukraine's city, country, and people. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is calling on Congolese President Joseph Kabila to respect his country's constitution and not run for a third term. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports from Kinshasa.
Following talks with President Kabila, Secretary Kerry announced an additional $30 million in support for transparent and credible Congolese elections.
I encouraged President Kabila to work with his government and the parliament in order to complete the election calendar and the budget. And they need to do so in accordance with the Constitution.
U.S. officials say that means respecting electoral timetables and constitutional limits that prevent Mr. Kabila from seeking a third term in 2016. The president's political opponents fear Mr. Kabila will again change the Constitution to allow another term, as he did in 2011. Kerry commended the Kabila government's work to combat ethnic militia in eastern Kivu provinces and said the Obama administration will continue to help improve standards of living there. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Kinshasa.
Officials in northern Afghanistan have given up hope of finding more survivors after a massive landslide that buried hundreds of villagers under tons of rock and mud on Friday. Rescuers today have turned their focus to providing food, shelter, and medical aid to around 4,000 people displaced by Friday's disaster. Richard Danziger is the chief of an Afghanistan mission for the International Organization for Migration.
We in the international organization have been bringing blankets and household items, solar lanterns, and there are a number of NGOs and UN agencies also bringing items such as tents, food, hygiene supplies, and so forth.
Estimates of the dead and missing vary from a few hundred to more than 2,700. The final figure may never be known because the scene has been declared a mass grave and many people remain missing. An Egyptian court sentenced 102 Islamist supporters of ousted former President Mohamed Morsi to 10 years in prison for rioting and possession of weapons. Those sentences may be reduced on appeal. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The judge pounded his gavel to signify that the court session had ended after sentencing 102 Islamist defendants to 10 years in prison. The men were accused of rioting with intent to cause violence, damage property, and illegally possessing firearms. The ruling, which may be appealed, relates to violence last July in which one man died. Unlike several recent cases in the southern city of Minya, in which hundreds of defendants were given the death penalty, no harsh verdicts were handed down Saturday. International critics have blasted Egypt for issuing hundreds of death sentences in the Minya cases, but many of those verdicts will be later reduced on appeal. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has left Beijing on a four-nation tour of Africa, saying labor disputes and other problems with Chinese investments in Africa are showing what he called signs of growing pains. In a statement before today's departure, Li urged Chinese companies in Africa to abide by local laws and regulations and take responsibility to protect the interests of local communities and the environment.
Commanding curve has taken second, but California Chrome shines bright!
And it was pre-race favorite, California Chrome bursting ahead of the pack on Saturday to easily win the Kentucky Derby. The victory at Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky, makes California Chrome's trainer, 77-year-old Art Sherman, the oldest man to train a race winner. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News. More news at voanews.com.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Thanks for joining us.
He's a young man with an enormous amount of time to be able to continue to contribute to his country. And I'm quite confident that he will weigh all of those issues as he makes a decision about the future. But
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry urges Congolese President Joseph Kabila to respect his country's constitution and not run for a third term.
Gauteng is going to be a very close race, according to all the recent polls, between the ANC and the Democratic Alliance.
South Africans are ready themselves for the polls this week.
People have turned to armed violence because the traditional dispute resolution mechanisms collapsed.
And armed conflict over land rights displaces hundreds of thousands of people in Darfur. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is calling on Congolese President Joseph Kabila to respect his country's constitution and not run for a third term. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stans reports from Kinshasa, where the U.S. pledged additional funding for elections and for helping to demobilize fighters in eastern provinces.
Following talks with President Kabila, Secretary Kerry announced an additional $30 million in support for transparent and credible Congolese elections. U.S. officials say that means respecting electoral timetables and constitutional limits that prevent Mr. Kabila from seeking a third term in 2016. The president's political opponents fear Mr. Kabila will again change the constitution to allow another term, as he did in 2011. Kerry says he believes the president's legacy will be defined by improving security in eastern provinces and putting Congo on a continued path of democracy.
He's a young man with an enormous amount of time to be able to continue to contribute to his country. And I'm quite confident that he will weigh all of those issues as he makes a decision about the future. But clearly, the United States of America believes that a country is strengthened. The people have respect for their nation and their government when a constitutional process is properly implemented and upheld by that government.
Kerry commended the Kabila government's work to combat ethnic militia in eastern Kivu provinces and said the Obama administration will continue to help improve standards of living there.
Lasting peace will not grow out of the barrel of a gun. It will come from restoring state authority and state services and providing the capacity building that is necessary in those areas that have been recaptured from armed groups.
Much of the turmoil in Congo's east stems from the upheaval of the Rwandan genocide 20 years ago and two wars against the government in Kinshasa, the first of which brought the president's father, Laurent Kabila, to power. Kerry said it's important that Congo and its eastern neighbors, Uganda and Rwanda, follow through on demobilizing those combatants who qualify for amnesty while holding to account their leaders.
People who may have been engaged in crimes against humanity, war crimes, those people remain liable for that. But others who sign the agreement and sign the amnesty are permitted to and encouraged, obviously, must return to their homes.
U.S. Special Envoy to the Great Lakes, former Senator Russ Feingold, says the Obama administration is working with Congolese authorities to establish mixed courts at trial and appellate levels that would have a majority of Congolese jurists, but would also include other African judges. Those courts would be impaneled to try leaders of groups such as the M23 militia, which the United States says was backed by Rwanda, as well as the FDLR, which includes some of those who led Rwanda's genocide. Rwandan President Paul Kagame says demobilizing Kivu militia must include all of the groups fighting there, including the FDLR. Secretary Kerry says he discussed that issue with President Kabila and says the Congolese leader gave him his word that he has a specific process in mind and timing. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Kinshasa.
Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has left Beijing on a four-nation tour of Africa, saying labor disputes and other problems with Chinese investments on the continent were signs of what he called growing pains. In a statement released before his departure on Sunday, Li urged Chinese companies in Africa to abide by local laws and regulations and take responsibility to protect the interests of local communities and the environment. He also called on relevant African countries to strengthen market regulation and protect the lawful rights and interests of Chinese companies and the safety of their employees. The premier will be visiting Ethiopia, Nigeria, Angola, and Kenya on his week-long trip.
Meanwhile, in Egypt, a court has sentenced 102 Islamist supporters of ousted former President Mohamed Morsi to 10 years in prison for rioting and possession of weapons. Many sentences handed down by Egyptian courts are later reduced on appeal. Edward Irenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The judge pounded his gavel to signify that the court session had ended after sentencing 102 Islamist defendants to 10 years in prison. The men were accused of rioting with intent to cause violence and damage property and illegally possessing firearms. The ruling, which may be appealed, relates to violence last July in Cairo's Azahar district, in which one man died. That death, in accordance with Egyptian law, allowed the prosecution to charge the defendants with murder. Unlike several recent cases in the southern city of Minya, in which hundreds of defendants were given the death penalty, no harsh verdicts were handed down Saturday. International critics have blasted Egypt for issuing hundreds of death sentences in the Minya cases, but many of those verdicts will be quashed and other cases will be retried. In a separate case being tried Saturday, an Egyptian judge allowed three journalists working for Al Jazeera English TV to be released from their metal cages to briefly address the bench. One of the three journalists questioned the bench about judicial procedure in his case before pointing out that Saturday's session was taking place on International Press Freedom Day. No verdict was reached, however, and the trial was adjourned until May 15. A fourth journalist employed by Al Jazeera TV's Al Jazeera Direct Network was ordered detained for another 45 days in an unrelated case. Abdullah Shami is also reported to be on a hunger strike, and Al Jazeera TV says that his weight has dropped by 40 kilos. Lucie Morion of Journalists Without Borders tells VOA that World Press Freedom Day is a good time to remember the Al Jazeera TV journalists and others being held for doing their jobs. She says that May 3rd is a time to honor those journalists who fight to provide us the news, and it is distressing to see many journalists, including those of Al Jazeera TV, imprisoned in Egypt. She argues that the Egyptian government is trying them for disseminating false information, but she thinks they are being persecuted for supporting or defending the Muslim Brotherhood. Saturday was the first official day of campaigning for Egypt's May 26th and 27th presidential election, and Hamdine Sabahi, who will face off against former Defense Minister Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, addressed his supporters. Sabahi told the audience that if elected, the government will serve the people rather than the people serving the government. Al Arabiya TV reported that General Sisi began his campaign by inaugurating the hashtag Tahia Masr, or Hail Egypt. Egypt's Electoral Commission is also investigating charges that Sabahi announced his electoral platform before the campaign officially got underway. It is not clear what, if any, punishment will be meted out for the alleged infraction. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has ordered top security officials to do everything possible to secure the release of the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by suspected Islamist extremists last month. Presidential adviser Ruben Abati says Mr. Jonathan issued the directive Sunday after holding closed-door talks with security service chiefs, senior officials, and the head of the school where the girls were seized. The mass abduction took place on April 15th when gunmen attacked the town of Chibok in Borno State. About 50 of the 276 abducted girls are said to have since escaped. The kidnapping has been blamed on the militant Islamist group Boko Haram, whose five-year insurgency has killed thousands. The group has been known to kidnap young women for use as servants and spies. The local press has reported that some of the kidnapped girls have already been sold as wives to combatants. Community leaders in Chibok say they believe some of the girls have been moved across the border into Cameroon and Chad.
Meanwhile, this week, South Africans go to the polls to elect new national and provincial legislatures. The winning party will then name the president and provincial premiers. Many analysts expect the African National Congress to maintain an overwhelming but slightly reduced majority and renew the mandate of President Jacob Zuma. They also expect the main opposition, the Democratic Alliance, to make gains because of accusations of corruption within the ANC and continuing complaints of high unemployment and slow delivery of services. From Washington, William Eagle reports.
For months, opinion polls had shown lagging public confidence in the ANC. The drop is blamed in part on the expenditure of millions of tax dollars and lavish improvements of the presidential complex at Nkandla. Public opinion also reflected disapproval of the violent police response to striking miners in Marikana 2 years ago. But a recent poll by the research company Ipsos showed that 65% of voters still intend to vote for the ANC, at least on the national level. Yaki Siliers is the director of the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria. He says South Africans still vote on party loyalty rather than policy. Many black South Africans reward the ANC for ending white rule 20 years ago. And he says while many urban supporters are critical of corruption scandals, rural voters overwhelmingly credit the party for improving their lives.
You must remember the ANC is more than 100 years old. It's got an unparalleled brand. And there are two stories about South Africa. The one story is, the story of Nkandla, corruption, and so on. The other story is really, if you look quite carefully at what the ANC has been able to deliver, it has been access to electricity, social grants, infrastructure in rural areas. These things are not that visible to many South Africans. But I've just spent the last 2 days driving from East London in the Eastern Cape through to Durban. And you can see the extent of impact that the ANC has made in rural areas.
Others attribute the successful patronage systems built by parties with origins as liberation movements. Hussein Solomon is a professor of political studies at the University of the Free State in Bloemfontein, South Africa.
It took the Congress Party in India almost 50 years to lose elections. Them, of course, saying that we delivered you from the British Raj, we delivered you from the British Raj, okay? What I'm saying to you is that there's still a loyalty to the ANC. At the same time, the ANC has been very smart, conflating state and party, government and party, in that they've been handing out food parcels, putting up buildings, and so on, and claiming this is the ANC government is doing this way, putting up concerts for the youth. So, don't worry about all of our failures for the next 2 hours. You're going to have food and you're going to have great music.
The elections may also help boost the main opposition, the Democratic Alliance. Some polls of registered voters say the party could increase its share of the vote from roughly 17% to 23%. Siliers says there are some factors working in the DA's favor. He says urban dissatisfaction may lead some voters to split their vote for the provincial and national leadership. Helping the DA in a close race are parties to the left of the ANC, like the Economic Freedom Fighters, headed by the charismatic former leader of the ANC Youth League, Julius Malema. His party could take votes away from the ANC, as could a campaign by some party supporters. They are asking voters to protest against the ANC by choosing an alternative party, or by casting a no vote or blank ballot. The Democratic Alliance already controls one of the country's nine provinces, the Western Cape, and some, including analyst Hussein Solomon, say it could win the richest, Gauteng, or at least the commercial capital there, Johannesburg.
Gauteng is going to be a very close race, according to all the recent polls, between the ANC and the Democratic Alliance. And to complicate matters further, the ANC leadership of Gauteng, which is the richest province, I think about half of the GDP of South Africa comes from there, is a person called Paul Mashatile. He was actually opposed to Zuma's candidacy as president of the ANC and was actually campaigning against him. So there's all kinds of tensions inside the ANC there.
Siliers does not think this election is a turning point. It's hard to beat the ANC brand, he says. But future polls, including municipal elections, will be another opportunity for opposition parties to expand their influence. If that's the case, he says, the question is whether the ANC will continue to accept the wins and losses that come with a democracy, or whether party leaders believe they've earned the right to rule at any cost. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Armed conflict over land rights has displaced hundreds of thousands of people in Darfur in recent months. The international anti-poverty organization Oxfam says the land rights system in Darfur is causing its communities to fight each other. It says the recent discovery of oil and gold in the region is fueling more violence and forcing thousands of people off their land. VOA fellow Nabil Biagio has more.
Fighting over land in Darfur has been going on for years, but it has intensified in recent years because of the discovery of oil and gold in the region. Mark Cohen, a senior researcher at Oxfam America, explains that in the past, farmers and herders used the land to their mutual benefit, but now they're killing each other to have exclusive access to land under weakened tribal administrations.
People have turned to armed violence because the traditional dispute resolution mechanisms collapsed. They were based on multiple use and traditional leaders, village sheikhs, allocating rights to use land.
Cohen says now that oil and mineral deposits have been found, there's even more fighting between farmers and pastoralists. He says the government is adding to the problem.
In addition, in recent years, there has been acquisition of land by investors. So it's quite easy for people from outside the region to acquire land. And so this has meant that both the farmers and pastoralists of the region no longer have access to land.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister, confirms that armed violence over natural resources routinely erupts in the troubled region. But he says the government cannot regulate gold mining activities in Darfur.
They go there, they search with the scanner for gold. It is not actually which you can regulate by law. Sometimes you find a very rich place full of gold, and this is where it can erupt some sort of struggle.
But Bilal insists this has changed.
Now, after that happened, the government took over the place.
Observers dispute that claim. Rasha Attiyani, engineer and civil activist from Darfur, says the conflict comes from an outdated system run by tribes.
There is an old system called Hakura, which entails that a particular piece of land is strictly owned by a particular person or family or tribe.
Attiyani explains that conflict arises when multiple parties claim the same piece of land and forbid its use by any other groups.
So many tribes say this is our land, and the mere trespassing of someone from outside the tribe is immediately a crime.
And if that happens, armed men often shoot and kill the alleged trespassers. Darfur is further decimated by ongoing fighting between government-backed militias and armed tribal groups that has continued for at least a decade. Human rights groups accuse the government of carrying out near-daily aerial bombardments on Darfur. United Nations agencies estimate that the war in Darfur has claimed the lives of more than 200,000 civilians and left more than 2 million internally displaced persons in need of urgent assistance. President Omar al-Bashir is wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Hip-hop may still be a man's world in Senegal, but more women are breaking into the so-called urban arts. VOA's Anne Luke reports from Dakar on how a local organization is holding workshops to mentor, train, and try to help the country's next generation of female hip-hop artists find their own voices.
Hip-hop takes serious work. That was the refrain of a week of workshops for young women in Dakar, organized by the local non-governmental organization Afrique Urbaine. There was a graffiti art show and slam poetry, as well as music and dance instruction. Dance instructor Huja Touré from the Sunu Street studio worked with a group of teenage girls on a series of geometric arm movements. Right angles, like the window panes, she said. Two, three, four, five, she says, demonstrating. We practice, we practice, we practice, she says, until it's perfect. For the aspiring female rappers upstairs, it was an intense week of writing, rewriting, and laying down tracks in the studio. The women collaborated on two songs that they performed at the week's final event. One of them, a Take Me As I Am anthem. The other on the theme, Free Voice. The crowd cheered in appreciation at the rhythmic flow of 18-year-old Nikita's verse. What I'm saying in my verse, she says, is it's time to give women a chance to say what they want to say in hip-hop. The same chance, she says, that men get to express themselves. But 25-year-old rapper Sister LB says they can't keep waiting on the men to invite them in. I know sooner or later I'm going to be somebody, she says. That's what matters. I believe in myself. She says it's not you who's going to help me make it. I have to help myself, so you can help me. Industry insiders here say female artists need polished skills and resources to go pro. Prominent Senegalese rapper Katie coached the women on their writing during the week. Up to now, he said, during the open debate before their performance, it's been the two extremes, the women acting like tomboys or trying to be Rihanna. He says, can we get to a point where female Senegalese rappers just get up on stage and be who they really are without feeling like they have to play a part? But female rapper and the event's MC, Muna, said that is easier said than done in the mainstream. Let's be honest, she says, people love us when we wear miniskirts and heels. But when you come as an intellectual, she says, with something clear and smart to say, there's a problem. People get annoyed, she says, you are no longer a doll. That isn't stopping this new generation of female rappers from taking on big issues in their verse. Motherhood, love, poverty, education. When they take that mic, they say their voices must speak for thousands. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
Coming up in the second half of the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, and music from African Collection.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
It's time now for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos and join Segun on the dot at DMA. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, May 4th. African soccer's governing body, CAF, has banned the Gambia for 2 years from all its competitions for fielding ineligible players in the qualifying series for the 2015 Under-20 African Youth Championship. CAF announced the ban this weekend following the meeting of its executive committee chaired by President Issa Hayatou. It said the decision was in line with the relevant rules guiding the Under-20 Championship. Last month, the organizing committee for the Under-20 Championship disqualified the West African nation from the competition for fielding 5 players who did not meet the stipulated age criteria in the qualifier against Liberia on April 6th. All the 5 players were born in 1994, while the competition is open to players born on January 1st, 1995 or after. Following the disqualification, CAF launched an investigation into the case of the player Ali Sowe, who was born on June 14, 1994. CAF found that Sowe had already registered with CAF in 2012 while playing for the Gamtel FC of Gambia in the CAF Confederation Cup, using the same passport number but a different date of birth, which is October 14, 1988. Since Gambia is paired against Seychelles in the first round of the qualifiers for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, its disqualification means an automatic second-round ticket for Seychelles. The CAF ban also covers all Gambian clubs, which will not feature in any of the 2 CAF club competitions for the duration of the ban. Although Gambia has never been to a major tournament, it has had some success in youth competition, winning the 2005 and 2009 African Under-17 Championships. African football has had regular problems with age cheating in youth tournaments. FIFA now uses magnetic resonance imaging, MRI scans, to catch age cheats at international youth tournaments. Turning to athletics, the 2022 Commonwealth Games may be a long time away, but the competition has been generating controversy. 2 cities, Durban in South Africa and Edmonton in Canada, are bidding to host the Games, a multi-sport event involving athletes from the Commonwealth of Nations. The host of the 22nd edition of the 4-yearly Games will not be announced until September 2, 2015. But a former president of the Athletic Federation of Nigeria, Dan Ngerem, has said Nigeria should not see the bid by South Africa to host the Games as the African bid. He says Nigeria's support for South Africa must be based on what Nigeria can benefit from such support.
I would have loved to say this is fantastic because I would have loved to characterize it as an African bid for the Commonwealth Games so that it can come to our shores for the very first time. But you see, they say those who must come to everything must come with clean hands. I don't think South African hands have been clean in terms of their relationship with Africa, particularly Nigeria. You know, we bid for Commonwealth Games, if you remember, a few years ago in Colombo. We did not get optimal support from most South African countries, and South Africa in particular. So it appears that our bid was booby-trapped, as it were, because South Africa was hoping to bid and forget about bidding for Commonwealth Games. What South Africa is really interested in is the Olympic Games, because they've successfully hosted the World Cup in 2010. The fundamental question to ask now is, what did Nigeria benefit in the 2010 World Cup? If you tell me to hazard a guess, we benefited nothing. And if you look at the historical antecedent of South Africa and Nigeria, this country has practically spilled blood to make South Africa what it is today. Thabo Mbeki used to live here, but the other street near this Lagos Motor Coast Club. Most South African companies are making mega billions in Nigeria. I can't see in the horizon remotely any Nigerian company that is doing anything significant in South Africa. So I've taken a long, circuitous route to come to my answer so that I can put things on a balance of equity. I haven't seen value added from South Africa. It cannot be a one-way traffic. So Nigeria must begin to demand and ask for commensurate support for our support on the continental level. It's a simple diplomacy, simple international relations.
You've been listening to Danun Gerem, a former president of the Athletic Federation of Nigeria, speaking on why Nigeria must not give a blind support to South Africa in its bid to become the first African nation to host the Commonwealth Games in 2022. Many thanks to reporter Tony Atkins for that interview. The 2014 Commonwealth Games will be held in Glasgow, Scotland, while the Gold Coast in Australia will host the 2018 edition. Now, how much importance should be attached to the story of the banana-eating footballer Dani Alves? Not much, if you ask Brazil legend Pelé. Pelé says the outrage at the throwing of a banana toward compatriot and Barcelona defender Dani Alves was a social media storm in a teacup. Alves ate the banana thrown on the pitch near him during a match at Villarreal, Spain, and the host club banned the fan who threw the banana for life. Right after, the Twitter space buzzed with acclaim for the player's cool reaction to what is considered a terrible act of racism. But Pelé on Friday said the incident has been blown out of proportion. It is not just in football where there is racism. It's been around in all sectors of society for a long time, Pelé says. Barcelona and Brazil star Neymar was one of those who praised Alves after launching an anti-racist campaign on social media with the hashtag "We're all monkeys." Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff likewise hailed Alves' reaction. But Pelé insisted, "I do not agree there is a wave of racism. In my day, people threw guanabana fruits and mangoes at players." In more football news, legendary Moroccan goalkeeper and former African Footballer of the Year Badou Zaki has been named the coach of the country's national team, known as Atlas Lions, for a second time. The 55-year-old Zaki replaces interim coach Hassan Benabicha. The new coach will take charge of the Lions through the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations to be hosted by the North African country. Zaki also played for the Atlas Lions, featuring in many Africa Cup of Nations, as well as the World Cup. He previously coached the Moroccan national team between 2002 and 2006. Turning to boxing news, Floyd Mayweather Jr. on Saturday retained his welterweight title by defeating Marcos Maidana in the majority decision. The scorecards were 117-111, 116-112, and 114-114. After the tough fight in Las Vegas, United States, Mayweather remained unbeaten, but not by much. Maidana swarmed all over him from the opening bell and gave him perhaps his toughest fight in his 16-year professional career. Cut over his eye and temporarily blinded by a headbutt in the fourth round, Mayweather had to rally in the last half of the fight to avoid losing for the first time since he was beaten on a controversial decision at the 1996 Olympics. Mayweather, who earned $32 million for the fight, was a 6-1 favorite to remain unbeaten. Now to our weekly World Cup tidbits. It is now 38 days to the kickoff of the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, and the countdown continues. Put your flags up in the sky, in the sky. That's the official song of the 2014 FIFA World Cup, entitled "We Are One." Now, how far will Nigeria advance at the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil? The answer depends on who you ask. But a former coach of the Super Eagles of Nigeria, Clemens Westerhoff, says the team will reach the second round of the World Cup with one match to spare. I strongly believe Nigeria will qualify for the round of 16 before their match against Argentina. The football website Kickoff Nigeria quotes Westerhoff as saying, "For me, Iran and Bosnia are no worries for the Super Eagles. We will always beat them." Nigeria, one of Africa's five representatives in Brazil, is in the same first-round group as Iran, Bosnia Herzegovina, and Argentina. And two World Cup host cities are in the news this weekend. A Brazilian football fan was killed when he was struck in the head by a toilet bowl thrown from the stands as supporters of rival clubs clashed in the northeastern World Cup host city of Recife. Also this weekend, authorities detained more than 40 fans because of fighting outside the stadium that will host World Cup matches in the nearby city of Natal. A police officer in Recife said the death occurred on Friday at Aruda Stadium after a second division match between Santa Cruz and visiting Paraná. The officer said fans ripped three toilet bowls out of stadium restrooms and threw them from the stands. He said one hit and instantly killed a fan he identified as Paulo Ricardo Gomes da Silva. The incident comes 6 weeks before Brazil hosts the World Cup. Five tournament games will be played in Recife, although none at the Aruda. The city will host World Cup matches at the new Arena Pernambuco. In Natal, fans clashed before a match between rival ABC and America in a test event at the Arena das Dunas on Saturday. Fans from both clubs were detained and taken to a police station for interrogation. Violence involving fan groups are common in Brazil, and the number of incidents escalated last year. FIFA and Brazilian authorities have downplayed concerns about violence inside stadiums during the World Cup. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Douglas the Mighty Umpuga in Washington.
Thank you, Segun. Segun on the dot, Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports right here on Nightline Africa.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa and time for music from the continent. Enjoy! That was our Sunday music spot from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. How are you, Dr. Jonah?
Good evening, Africa. Once again, government officials, commentators, and concerned citizens in many parts of the world are expressing concerns about the proliferation and intensity of the activities of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, in the international community. Not too long ago, the Egyptian government that preceded the government of President Morsi arrested a number of NGOs, including some Americans, for so-called unauthorized activities in the country. Despite vocal protest by the United States government, the NGO members were prosecuted in court. Also recently, President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe raised questions about the activities of NGOs in his country. With respect to the trial of the Kenyan president and his deputy before the International Criminal Court, many Kenyans expressed serious concern that a prominent Kenyan NGO would intervene in the ICC to oppose a proposal that part of the trial should be held in Africa to facilitate the attendance of the president and his deputy. The court denied the proposal on the strength of the arguments put forward by the NGO. And the current controversy between Russia and Western countries, accusations are frequently made that Western NGOs are a disturbing factor in the crisis. Of course, in the past, there have been whispering campaigns of the activities of NGO in many African countries. However, African governments have been careful to avoid pointing fingers at the international NGOs, which are for the most part supported by the governments. More often than not, these NGOs are protected by the governments, and therefore they have significant leverage. Initially, when the NGOs emerged in the international scene, they performed a useful and essential role in the proper delivery of humanitarian assistance to vulnerable groups in conflict areas. But now, many have moved on to other issues, particularly in matters pertaining to human rights and treatment of people in Africa. Quite often, these NGOs prepared reports which are quickly and often given wide publicity, and governments have to react to them. It is now also a common practice for the United Nations to consult the international NGOs when discussing certain matters before the Security Council and other organs. Some of these NGOs are now referred to as non-state actors, and they have been obliged to propose or recommend concrete action to be taken by the Security Council or the General Assembly. What is worrying many African commentators is that while they can be useful, very little is known about their activities or about how they recruit members to the organizations. Some have observed that in many instances, they employ normal or usual critics of governments, and that may account for some of the critical remarks of the NGOs. So what is really required at this stage is not to prevent NGOs from performing their useful role, but to seek more transparency, such as how they are financed, how do they recruit their staff, and how do they prepare reports which are then sent to international organizations. These are issues which should be clarified so that people will have more confidence that NGOs are not agents of foreign governments. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. We'll be right back.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And hope you'll join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With the appointment of a new prime minister, Madagascar has taken an important step toward returning to democracy after 5 years of political and economic instability. Roger Colo, a medical doctor uninvolved in the island nation's recent tumultuous politics, was named to the post April 11th by President Ari Rajaonarimampian. The appointment follows President Rajaonarimampian's election in December, the first presidential poll since a coup toppled former President Marc Ravalomanana in 2009 and disrupted the nation's relations with many in the international community. The United States welcomes the formation of a new government, and we look forward to working with it to promote a prosperous, democratic, and healthy future for all Malagasy. Prime Minister Colo's appointment and that of a new slate of cabinet ministers presents an opportunity to break with the past and begin to rehabilitate the economy, strengthen the country's democratic institutions and rule of law, protect Madagascar's unique biodiversity, and restore respect for human rights. We remain one of Madagascar's largest partners, providing over $55 million last year for food security and health programs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.